Welcome to Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, a podcast for students by students, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of Measuring Success Right. I'm your host, Tim Kelleher. Today's guest is Professor Todd Mitten. Professor Mitten graduated summa cum laude from Brigham Young University in 1990 with a degree in economics. He continued his education at BYU and finished his MBA in 1993. After working for 2 years at a consulting company in SLC, he began the Financial Economics PhD program at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Upon finishing his PhD in 2000, Professor Mitten began teaching as a professor at the BYU Marriott School of Business, and now has been at BYU for 22 years. Professor Mitten is an active researcher, having published in the top academic finance journals. At the BYU Marriott School of Business, he has taught introductory finance, advanced corporate finance, and derivatives. Additionally, he will be introducing a new course in decentralized finance next semester. Professor Mitten, thank you for being with us here today.
Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
So first off, will you please give us an intro into what you're teaching this semester?
Yeah, so right now I'm teaching derivatives, which is futures and options. I've been teaching that class for about 10 years now.
And we'll get into it a little bit later, but you are starting a new finance class next semester.
Yes.
And are you excited for that?
I am excited about it, but it's a lot of work.
A lot of work. A yeah. Little nerve-wracking too, I imagine.
Yes.
So I want to start off with a little bit of where you came from. So you started at BYU in 1990. And when you started here, did you know right away that you were going to do economics, or did it take you time to figure out what you were passionate about?
It took me a long time, so I was originally a computer science major and went on a mission, and when I came back, wasn't as interested in computer science. So I think I thought about a lot of different majors, but then finally settled on economics because it was interesting to me and it didn't take too many hours to graduate, so it didn't take too long to finish up.
It was appealing for those reasons. And after doing economics, did you already know that you were planning on an MBA, or was there a process to get there?
I didn't know. It was something in the back of my mind. I thought I might do it, and I went and worked for a year and then decided I'd just go right back and get the MBA.
What was the intention with getting an MBA?
Yeah, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I was never someone that had a real clear vision of what my path would be for a career. And so I thought an MBA was a pretty good all-purpose degree, you know. It helped me in a lot of different fields. So I planned to get a job when I finished and didn't know exactly what field it would be in, though.
Okay. So it was, I'll get the MBA. It'll be useful for a lot of different things.
Then I'll figure something out.
And I'll figure something out after. Yeah. Okay. And that's after that is when you ended up in the consulting firm in Salt Lake City. How did you get there?
So I was just really applying for a lot of different jobs that I thought might be interesting without still not knowing exactly what I wanted to do. And this opportunity came up and it sounded pretty interesting. The consulting firm did business valuations and valuations of other things for litigation support. And it was an interesting opportunity that I thought would be good to do.
So you just went for it.
That was, yeah.
That was a plan. And I want to focus in on a little bit of this. So you're working in consulting, and then you pivot to going and getting a PhD. What's the process in there from working to then I'm going to go get a PhD?
So it's really, at least for me, it was just a matter of committing to do the PhD. It was always something I thought I might like to do, but it's kind of hard to commit to five more years of school, which at the time is about how long it took to get a PhD in finance. It's even longer now. It's more like 6 years. But just the thought of jumping into five more years of school was kind of daunting. So it was something I thought I might like to do, but I couldn't quite commit to actually doing it.
Yeah, I would imagine that 5 years of more school is quite daunting. And what was it about the PhD that drew you in?
I think I always just thought it would be a good fit for me. I always was very comfortable in academic settings, you know, as a student, and I thought I would enjoy an environment where I was, you know, continuing to learn new things and research and teach other people about things. I thought it would be a good fit for me, and I had other people tell me, you know, you seem like you'd be a good, you know, professor, you know, like that'd be a good fit for you. So I think I always thought it was something I might like to do, and it turned out to be right, I think.
Yeah, turned out to be right. You've been doing it for a very long time. Was there something that initially got it on your radar? Was it other people telling you, hey, I think you'd be a good professor, or was it the academic side, or what first got you interested?
Yeah, it's, you know, I didn't know anyone in my family or friends who was a professor, so it wasn't something that I'd been brought up to think about doing. But I think just as I was in college and I kind of observed my professors and the work that they did and the life that they had, it started to seem to be something that was appealing to me. So I think it was just observing others around me gave me the idea.
Okay. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I want to go back a little bit to the consulting to PhD. When did you know it was time to leave consulting? Was there something that occurred, or was it gradual?
It was gradual. It was a good job. I enjoyed it. But, you know, after being there for 2 years, I felt like I wasn't really learning a whole lot more, that I was just kind of stagnating a bit in the job. And one of the features about that job is that I wasn't always really busy, which is really challenging for me. So for a couple reasons, I felt like that job, I needed to move on from that job. And then, you know, the choice was to find another job or to try the PhD. And I kind of knew that if I didn't do it then, I probably would never do it, because the longer I waited, the harder it would be to actually jump in and do the PhD. And luckily I had a wife that encouraged me to get a PhD, you know, which was good for her, because that meant, you know, moving into a small apartment for 5 years, not earning much income, you know. And,
yeah.
It's a bit of a sacrifice for her to do that, but she encouraged me to do it. And so I decided if I was ever going to do it, it had to be then. So I just started applying for programs.
For students who are going into their first jobs, what advice would you give to them related to this?
I think keep yourself flexible so that you're able to make changes to what you're doing. You know, hopefully you'll love the first job that you get and can stay there for a long time, but you might not, like me. You might feel like you need to do something else. So you need to keep learning and exploring new options that might be out there, and also keep yourself financially flexible, meaning don't get too tied down to mortgage payments or car payments or anything, which makes it harder for you to switch careers if you need to, because it's not uncommon that, you know, you'll want to make a change after a few years. It happens a lot.
So. All right. So I want to pivot now into first arriving at BYU. Did you always know that you wanted to teach at BYU after earning your PhD, or was BYU just one of the options?
I think I had a strong preference for going to BYU. It wasn't the only option that I considered, but when they offered me a job, it felt right, and I felt like that was the place for me. So,
what do you enjoy so much about being here?
I think the students are fantastic at BYU. I mean, having been a professor for 22 years, and I can count very few times when any of the students have caused me any serious problems. And it's not like that at other universities, you know. I hear stories that, but I think the students are great. The faculty that I work with, the other professors, are also great. They've been good friends to me and great, a great support. And I've always just liked BYU and its mission, you know, ever since I came here as an undergrad. So I think for all those reasons, I really like it here.
Yeah. And more specifically, what would you say you enjoy about teaching?
So I think I like interacting with the students. Like I say, the students are great. But also, I think it's rewarding to me when I can take concepts that are kind of complicated or difficult and boil them down to something where I can easily explain it to others. Like, if I can get it, I usually don't think of things in a complicated way. So if I can sort of boil it down to where it makes sense to me, and then it's a way that I can explain it to the students, that's sort of like rewarding to me when I feel like I can make difficult things become understandable.
Yeah. When you first started teaching, was it a learning process to get teaching down, or did it kind of come naturally to you?
I think a little of both. I felt like I naturally was sort of good at explaining things and teaching things to other people. Like, I worked as a teaching assistant in my undergrad, and I felt like I was good at teaching things to others. But what was more of a learning curve was actually the managing of a class and writing exams and things like that. You know, you would think when you go to a PhD program, they spend a lot of time teaching you how to teach classes, but we didn't spend 1 minute on that in my PhD program. And I don't think that's unusual. I think some programs do. But so as far as just managing the class and organizing it, and that's where the steep learning curve was. And so, you know, in my first year or two of teaching, there were lots of times when I said to myself, well, I'm never going to do that again. That was a big mistake, you know.
Yeah.
But after a couple of years, I was able to figure that stuff out as well, and then things went a lot more smoothly.
What would you say is important when you first get into a job and you maybe realize, I don't have all the skills?
I think be humble enough to ask around to those who have more experience for their advice can be really helpful. And then, you know, don't try to pretend that you know things that you don't know. That's a problem we often have. We don't want to admit that we don't know things. That always doesn't lead to good things if we just aren't honest about things. So just being willing to learn and be humble, I think, is the main thing.
You've talked quite a bit about learning in whatever you're doing. How would you say that you do that personally?
So I read a lot, you know, even if it's not immediately related to what I'm doing in my job, I try to keep reading new things and learning new things, just sort of broaden my understanding in different areas. And the other thing is to accept new challenges. Like, if I take on a new research project, I can do it in an area where I'm familiar with it, or I can go into a new area that I'm not as familiar with. And I've tended more to go to areas that I'm not as familiar with, because that's going to force me to learn a whole new area of my discipline and sort of broaden my understanding of things. So part of it's being willing to get out of your comfort zone where you're forced to learn new things. If you're just trying to learn new things, you might not have the discipline to do it, but when you're forced to do it for a project or something that's, you know, new to you, then you really learn a lot more.
Yeah, you're forced to learn. Yeah. And with this concept of lifelong learning, what would you argue are some of the benefits of it?
I don't know. For me, it's just I think I feel better when I'm learning new things. Just feel stagnant, like I haven't learned anything new for a while. It's not very motivating to me, you know. I always feel like I want to be progressing in some way, and I think it just makes for a more fulfilling life to be able to continually learn.
So related to that, how do you keep lifelong learning as an aspect of your teaching?
So it's challenging because some of the classes that we teach, the discipline really doesn't change that much from year to year, and you're teaching the same class year after year sometimes, and there isn't really that much new that comes into the field over the course of 1 year that needs to be added to the course. So it's difficult to keep things fresh and new when you've taught the same thing, you know, many times over again, and the field isn't really changing all that much. So the challenge is I'm always looking for ways to improve the courses that I teach or change them in some way to make them a little bit more interesting or enlightening for the students, even if it's a change in the methodology or something, just to try to make it a little bit different and more exciting.
Yeah, finding little improvements in the class. And then would you say the research side of teaching also gives you a lot of that education?
Yeah, so with research, you know, the other half of my job, we do have the flexibility to choose whatever research projects we want to work on. And so I can choose wherever I think I can make a contribution and wherever it's interesting to me. And so that's a lot easier to sort of delve into new areas and find new things to learn about.
Yeah, so you're given a lot of freedom with what you decide.
That's right. I mean, our goal is to publish good research papers in good academic journals, so you can't just willy-nilly research whatever you want. It's got to be something other people are interested in as well. But you have a lot of freedom to choose what a project you want to take on.
Okay, very interesting. And I want to get a little bit into the new class, which is decentralized finance. Could you explain to the listeners a little bit of what decentralized finance is focused on?
Yeah, so most people have heard of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, and decentralized finance, or DeFi as it's usually called for short, is financial applications that are built upon the networks that these cryptocurrencies trade on. So especially the Ethereum network, which is the second most popular cryptocurrency after Bitcoin. So when I say financial applications on networks, it's like you can go to a bank and borrow money, but in decentralized finance, you would go to the cryptocurrency network or the blockchain network, as it's called, and there are applications there where you can borrow money as well. You can go to the New York Stock Exchange in the real world and buy different assets. Or you can go into the decentralized finance world on a blockchain network like Ethereum, and there you can purchase or trade different crypto assets. So DeFi is these applications that are being built up. It's still a new industry. It's only a few years old, but where they sort of replicate real-world financial applications, but in the world of blockchain networks.
How did you then take this topic and turn it into a class?
So I've been interested in it for about a year. I was talking to my daughter one day about a year ago, and she asked me about cryptocurrencies and how they worked, and I realized I couldn't really explain it. I didn't have a good understanding of it. I thought, you know, I should do better than that. I'm a finance professor, and so I started studying it and became really intrigued by this world of decentralized finance. And so I've just been studying it in any time that I have available. And then, you know, after a while, I thought, you know, it would be good to offer a class to students on this subject. I know that there's a lot of students that are interested in it as well. And so I talked to our department chair about offering the class, and he thought it was a good idea as well. And so since then, I've been trying to prepare this class, and it's actually putting it into class form is difficult, especially in this case, because decentralized finance is a new field. There's no textbooks out there that I can just pick up a textbook and tell the students to read it. I've basically got to create all the curriculum and everything on my own. And so it's been doubly or triply difficult to actually put the class together.
Where do you look for the information or the sources?
So basically for every topic in the class, there's going to be resources that the students will read. And instead of just pointing them to a textbook, there's going to be academic papers that they can find online, even, you know, other things that people have written online explaining different aspects of DeFi. And I'm basically collecting materials from all over the internet and putting them together to give students sort of a made-up textbook from all different places all over the internet.
Yeah, and I think that's a good lesson. So you don't necessarily have everything you need, but you've gone out there and kind of made it work. What advice would you give to people who are in that same kind of circumstance? How do you go out there and make something of nothing, basically?
Well, it's the information age, so, you know, this would have been a lot harder 20 years ago when there's not so many resources out there. But I find that if you look hard enough, usually there's someone who's already done what you're trying to figure out or explain. And so if I search long enough when I'm trying to understand something, I'll usually find someone who's gone through the same process and figured it out. And often there'll be something someone has written, and I'm just amazed at how they have sort of crystallized this very complex topic and put it into a paper for people to understand. And so basically I'm relying on the good work of others to kind of get up to speed in what I need to do. So whether that's applicable in all jobs, I don't know, but I think usually there's other people out there that have been down the path that you're trying to go down and can help you out.
So what, other than compiling the resources, what else is necessary to create a new class?
So you got to have materials that students can refer to. You've got to prepare each class session. How's it going to go? What are you going to talk about that session? What do you want the students to learn that session? Then there's got to be some exercises of some sort that the students can work through on their own to sort of deepen their understanding of the topics that we talk about. And then you got to figure out how to test the students on what they've learned. So that's challenging. I mean, students often worry about taking tests, but it's 10 times harder to actually write a test for students to take and to make it fair and efficient and productive. And so those are kind of all the pieces that go into putting a course together.
Yeah. And is it fair to say that's kind of a learning process? Like the first year will not be perfect, but by the next year and then the year after, you kind of go refining it.
Yeah. So first year is always a little bit bumpy. The second time through is much better. And then usually by the third or fourth time, you kind of get into a zone where you've pretty much got the course figured out. You're still kind of tinkering with it and making improvements, but it's mostly in place by about the third year usually.
And to wrap up, what are you most excited for about this class?
I think it's really motivating to teach something that is really new. It's a really new field. There's not many courses on this topic being taught around the world, and so we're kind of on the leading edge of that. It's just been fun for me to learn really what's a whole new field, you know, and it's something that it could be the next big thing, you know. It might be the wave of the future. I'll stipulate it might not. It might all come crashing down. We'll see. But it's exciting to see something that could be, you know, a really new big wave of the future.
So we've talked a lot about your career and some of your past accomplishments, and I want to move into a little bit more of professional advice and personal life. As a teacher, and I imagine creating a new class, you're very busy with that and with research. How do you balance those work responsibilities with your family and your religious responsibilities?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as a professor, you are very busy. You have a lot to do. But one of the nice things about it is that your time is somewhat flexible. You can kind of work the hours that you want to work. I mean, apart from being in class when that's set, but otherwise you can kind of do the other things that you need to do when it fits your schedule, which is helpful. It's been helpful for me because my family situation was, we had two sons that were born with special needs that had cerebral palsy, so they're both one passed away in 2014, but the other is still with us. But it's been very challenging to take care of them. So the flexibility of being able to help out with them at home or doctor's appointments or whatever it might be has been really a great blessing for me. So balancing work and family, I think, means a little something different to me because of my kids. I've been grateful to be in a career where I was able to give them the attention that they need.
What advice would you give to people who are seeking a better balance between their work responsibilities and their family life? Is there anything that you've taken away from teaching that you would like to pass on to them?
I could be wrong, but I think a lot of it is just really what's in your heart, what's most important to you. I mean, there are people who are in a job and they don't really have a choice and they have to, you know, work so hard to provide for their families. And that can be a tough situation. But there are others who just work excessively just because that's what's really in their heart and that's what they want to do is just keep working and earning as much money as they can. And so I think just the most important thing is, where is your heart, you know? And hopefully it's not just with wanting to get ahead and make money, but to have a more well-rounded life and to take care of your family. And taking care of them means being with them and serving them and so on. So I think getting your heart in the right place is the main thing.
So what other advice would you give to students who are just graduating college?
Focus on finding something that you love doing. Don't chase too much after prestige or money. Not to say that those things are all bad, but Don't focus too much on them. You'll be much happier in life if you find something that you really like doing and that's rewarding and allows you to help other people in some way. I think you'll have a happier life even if you sacrifice a little prestige or money along the way.
Professor Mitten, thank you very much for being with us today. Our final question for you is, in your life, how do you measure success?
I think Yeah, that's a big question, but I think ultimately I measure success by how I think God views my life. If I think God is happy with my life, then I think that's successful. And there's a lot of parts to that. You know, do I think God's happy with how I'm treating my family? Do I think God is happy with how I am serving my employer? Do I think God is happy with how I'm treating my fellow man? All these things. Ultimately, and I'm probably not always successful at this, but that's ultimately how I'd like to measure my life, I guess.
Thank you to all the viewers who listened this week, and we'll see you next week.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect official policy or position of Brigham Young University or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.